kids? Do you like violence?
Are you sick to death of pussyfooting around the truth while being constantly fed lies by news and big tech tyrants? If so, then come join me, Dan Smotz, on The System Is Down, where we get weird, have fun, and dig into all the dangerous taboo topics like conspiracies, politics, religion, culture, current events, and everything your family just prays you don't bring up around the Thanksgiving dinner table. And I know that reality is scary to some people, so if you're easily offended, just ignore this and go back to making cat memes or whatever. But if you're ready to change the world for the better, come join me on The System Is Down at tsidpod.com or wherever you get podcasts. That's tsidpod.com, because the system is down and truth is taking over.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are now entering the Second Fleet Comics Podcast, starring Mark Clare and Rimzo Martinez.
This is Sparta! Those were the words uttered by one Gerard Butler in the film called 300, which is based on a graphic novel that we're going to be looking at today, which is based on a film that was based on a true historical event. We'll get into all of that in a few minutes, but before that, I could not do this alone, my friends. I have, as always, my Rick Jones, my ramblin', rambunctious partner in comic book crime, Remzo Martinez. Remzo, how's it going?
This is my profession, and it's great to be back. I want to go ahead and just say, this is one of those situations where many people look around and they think, oh, every book is better than the movie that ends up being made. But this might be this might be a little contentious for some people, because as I previewed it in a post over the Second Print Comics fan zone on Facebook the other day, some people gave some mixed reactions towards it. So I'm glad to be covering 300, because this is either a story, a film, a comic that people either absolutely love or they absolutely hate it, and there is no middle ground.
Yes, there is no middle ground, or is there? We shall see in this review. But yeah, it's funny to me that here we are. We're 31 issues into this podcast, and this is actually the first time we're looking at a Frank Miller book, and I'm surprised this is the one we're looking at first. It's just kind of how it happened. Something reminded me of the movie 300, and I said, hey, we haven't done 300. Hey, we haven't done Frank Miller. Hey, let's do 300. So here we are. But before we get into this book specifically, why don't we just talk a little bit about Frank Miller? To me, he's one of the very few people in the comic book industry who has excelled as both a writer and an artist, often with those two combined. There are not many I can say that of, so he's a true talent, a true top talent in the comic book industry. What is your personal history with Frank Miller? How do you view him as a comic book fan?
I got introduced to Frank Miller through his Daredevil run when he introduced Elektra, reading this about 20 years after it came out in print. Elektra completely took my heart, and that Daredevil run is really what, you know, I feel is the main canon of what makes Daredevil such a great, captivating character. Picked up some of his other stuff, Dark Knight Returns and Ronin. He's one of those people where it's like, you know, I might not always love everything he does, but I truly respect him as an artist. And in many ways, I always see him as kind of like the flip side to Alan Moore. He's a bit eccentric. He's a bit misunderstood. I always saw him as Freddy Krueger, because he's kind of skinny and he wears a cowboy fedora type of thing. And Alan Moore is definitely Jason, the silent butcher you in the woods type. So, you know, he's one of those people that,
you tried to drown me in a lake, and now I'm going to bloody kill you.
I'm going to murder a bunch of teens having sex in the cabin. Yeah, I mean, it's one of those people where it's like, you know, I like Alan Moore's stuff. When we did his Swamp Thing saga, like 10 episodes back, that's one of the highest rated episodes, one of the most downloaded episodes, too. I think that's awesome. I don't love all of Alan Moore's stuff. I like The Watchmen, but, like, you know, when it comes to League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, like, holy shit, I would never buy that for anybody, because it's like buying pornography. You do not gift people pornography like that. It's just like, it's like, I don't want to sound like a prude or anything. Like, some people should not see this. I mean, art is art, but, like, Jesus Christ, it is they're men of a very unique flavor. Let's put it that way.
Well, this is going to be interesting because I these are all like I remember buying and reading League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, and I remember liking it. But keep this in mind, this is 25 plus years ago. So just like the book we're going to go through today, I'm very curious to see how some of this stuff holds up to me, because I think there was a time in my comic book fanhood where I was perhaps so in awe of certain artists or certain writers that perhaps I just viewed everything through a certain lens, or the lens of a less refined fan. Some of which may hold up, some of which may not. So I mean, it's one of the many reasons that I wanted to do this show, because I get to take another look at a lot of this stuff that much of which I haven't opened the pages of in 20, 25 years. Not to constantly age myself here, but I've been reading comics for a long time, my friends.
ARP, we're waiting to shill for you. Just send us that moolah.
They're going to be our top sponsor. But that being said...
But before we get started, yeah. Got some house notes.
Oh, sure, yes.
February was a, because everyone needs a token administrator's type. February was a great month. Thank you to all of our new patrons. You know, we do this content for you. We come out every week because we love the community that we've been able to establish with the SPC Nation. I do also want to go ahead and just read off one of our recent reviews on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, if you're old like me, as somebody mentioned the other day. This is... from February 21st, Brodiphius 18. I do not think that's his biblical name, but he gave us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. Both members of this podcast are true comic fans, comic historians, and a little twisted and demented all at the same time. Every episode is super thorough, super funny, loaded with details and fun facts along the way. Favorite episodes have been Flashpoint Review and the All Mutant Draft. He's talking about our X-Men draft we did with good friends Jenny and Matt way back when. We will go ahead and include to those episodes in the show notes because we love you. But please keep those reviews coming. It helps us get in those trending charts, lets people know the fun we're having, and keeps the nation growing.
Tremendous, tremendous review. They never go unnoticed. They never go overlooked. We always appreciate the kind words from our fans out there. So that being said, any more housekeeping? Should we tell them how they can pay us money
if they want? Second print.
Mention that.
Might as well. Patreon.com/secondprintpod. That's patreon.com/secondprintpod. Every Sunday, we've got Remso Rants, where I dive into a topic that you guys want me to go ahead and scream about. Every Wednesday for the next couple of weeks, we've got a new series out called Remso versus the MCU Phase 1, where I look at the first phase of Marvel Cinematic Universe films, such as Iron Man, Thor, The Avengers, Captain America, and I go ahead and tweak them to make them a little bit better. So whether you have your own thoughts on how you could have improved what are really, you know, universally loved movies, or whether you want to say I'm full of shit, tune in. We've got Claire's Continues. We've got Mark. Mark, you're starting a new segment now. It's the random comic with Mark Hour or something.
Something like that. Hopefully not a full hour, because the idea is that this is something I can do when I just can carve out a little bit of time. So
when he's on the shitter.
Yes, basically. So what I'm going to be doing.
Shit talk with Mark.
Occasionally. For those of you out there who have the Marvel Unlimited app, I discovered an amazing feature. They have this little button in the upper left-hand corner. It's like two little question marks. You press that button, and they give you a random Marvel comic from over its 50 or 60-year history to read. So that's what I'm going to be doing. I'm going to randomly at times, whenever I feel like it, press that button, read a comic, and do a little review of it for our patrons exclusively. I have already done one of these, so our patrons should be hearing it right now, or if you sign up right now, you can go hear it. The first episode I looked at, Giant Size Master of Kung Fu number 3 from 1976. Yes. And this is actually my first exposure to Shang-Chi. I've never read a Shang-Chi comic before. And I'm just going to save my thoughts for the show. That's why you got to cough it up, my friends. But yeah, and that's why I like this segment, because it's, again, just like this podcast, it's not just for you guys. It's also for me. It's also to give myself a reason to read more things and expose myself to more things. And I just love this idea of randomly reading a random issue and exposing myself to certain characters or storylines that I just haven't happened to be exposed to before. So looking forward to doing that. Looking forward to leasing that to all of our wonderful patrons.
Oh, and just add the cherry on top, Mark, I recently hit up one of my local comic book shops in the area and grabbed from the shelf a shrink-wrapped hardcover Marvel Select graphic novel of one of the most important Spider-Man stories to ever come out, Spider-Man: Kraven's Last Hunt, and I am mailing that in the morning to one of our Journey into Mystery patrons. At the $25 level or higher, Mark and I will go ahead and hand-select a hardcover graphic novel and mail it to you every 3 months. Past graphic novels include Green Lantern, Earth 1, Volume 1, Killer Be Killed, Volume 1, the DC... German and English. the DC...
Sin City?
Sin City.
Sin City, Dame to Kill For.
The DC Rebirth Deluxe, Daredevil Season 1. I mean, the list goes on. If any of those catch your fancy, and you can already tell that Mark and I have some pretty good taste in the stuff we're sending you, please...
I like to think so.
So much and more. Patreon.com/secondprintpod. That's all I got.
All righty. Well, that being said, it's time to dive into Frank Miller's 300, released in 1998, published by Dark Horse Comics, also the home of Hellboy. I believe that's the only other Dark Horse comic that we have looked at so far. So when Frank Miller grew up, just a little backstory here, he was a big fan of the movie, I believe it's called 300 Spartans or something of that. Yeah, the 300 Spartans. This is a 1962 movie. That film was the depiction of the Battle of Thermopylae, I believe is how you say it, where the gigantic Persian army went to invade Greece, and they were held back by 300 brave Spartans who, while they did die... they did inflict massive, massive damage and, you know, help their fellow Greeks to fend off the Persian army in some way, shape, or form. Frank Miller was very obsessed with this movie and wanted to adapt it into a graphic novel, which he did in this book, 300, which was, of course, later adapted into a movie by our friend Zack Snyder, which we'll talk about that movie a bit as well. This is a historical event adapted into a movie, adapted into a graphic novel, and then readapted into a movie. But we're going to be looking at the graphic novel edition. Again, this is Frank Miller's 300, and it is truly Frank Miller's 300. He is the writer of this book. He is the artist of this book, along with Lynn Varney doing the colors. But this is basically all Frank Miller all the time, as is often the case with a lot of his seminal works. So we start off. We are not even identified historically yet at this point. We just start off with a big splash page of a bunch of people marching along, and it says, "We march." I'm just going to read the beginning here. "From dear Laconia, from sacred Sparta, we march. For honor's sake, for glory's sake, we march." And this is when we learn we are actually here in 480 BC, and we see the Spartans marching upon a hill. And one of the Spartans here, he stumbles down. They're all wearing these red capes and this pretty badass looking armor. But one of the Spartans, he falls down, he gets dizzy, and now he's being beaten and punished by his captain. My God, these Spartans do not fuck around. You tumble and your own captain will beat the shit out of you, right? Spartans are tough as nails, is what we learn right away. They refer to him as Stumblios. But Stumblios here, he's not taking shit from his captain. He actually fights back and ends up knocking his captain unconscious. So I'm a big fan of Stumblios here. Even though he stumbles, he's not going to take shit from anybody, including his own captain. And this does catch the attention of the true leader of the Spartans here, which is, we will soon learn, is King Leonidas. Stumblios, for the punishment for beating his captain nearly unconscious, or not nearly unconscious, unconscious, he has to carry him, and he does not get food until the journey is over. So again, Spartans are touched, man. Spartans are tough. And talking about going to bed without dinner, how about finishing an entire journey without any food while carrying your captain on your shoulders?
I cannot imagine what it would have to be like to be a soldier in the Spartan army. For those of you that don't know, I was in the National Guard for 6 years, 7 years or so. And, we would make fun of movies like this, because really when you're going through basic, when you're going through any intense military training, it's hard, but it's never Spartan hard. So, you know, by the time that I had gone through all of that, this movie is out, we would use parts and quotes from this movie to kind of bring some levity to the situation. I look back at that and I'm like, man, my worst moments were nothing compared to what those guys would ever have to deal with.
You weren't the stumbleos of your unit?
No, you want to know the worst thing that ever happened to me? My unit at Basic won the Best Platoon Award. So we actually got a few boxes of pizza, and we got to take a few hours off from training. This is towards the end. But somebody threw some litter on the floor, and because nobody went out of their way to pick it up, one of our drill sergeants saw it, and he was like, "What? No one's gonna pick up this trash? Everybody outside!" So him and another random second lieutenant assigned to my platoon did was they made us run around the fields back and forth. And at this point, like, you know,
this is after eating all the pizza.
And I mean, the food was not what I would call anything you want to eat during those weeks there. So we are just puking all over ourselves the entire time. And it was probably for like 15 minutes of sprinting back and forth. But when you've put yourself in this mindset of I can finally relax, when you finally eaten all this greasy, carby shit that you have not touched in weeks, I mean, just I could, oh God, like I can smell the vomit. Not a fond memory. But that's as
how long did it take you to? How long did it take you to eat pizza again after that?
I didn't want to eat it for a long time. Let's put it that way. I avoided pizza for a while. Actually, at graduation, my parents were taking me out to dinner. There was an Italian place, and they're like, you know, we haven't had pizza in a couple of weeks. Maybe we should go get it. And I was like, no, I want Chinese food. We're getting Chinese.
Well, that sounds rough, but not nearly as rough as what any old Spartan 100% on a day-to-day basis here. Yeah, I did a little research. You know, when I was researching this book, I ended up on a little bit of a YouTube rabbit hole, and somehow I ended up on a video that was just about what it was like to be a Spartan. And man, it was not fun. When you're a Spartan and you're a baby, the first thing they do, they take a baby, they take it to this council of elders, and they examine the baby. And if they see any flaws, or they think that they see something that indicates the baby might get sick or be deformed in some way, or just not grow up to be strong or a strong soldier, they take the baby and just leave it out in the wild. And of course, they usually die. Occasionally, the babies were rescued by foreigners or some kind of, you know, someone from the slave class that saved them. But basically from the moment you're born, there's a chance that not that low of a chance necessarily either, that just a bunch of dudes are gonna take one look at you and be like, nah, this guy's not gonna cut it.
Sparta, brought to you by Planned Parenthood.
Yeah, that was before you could just pop in for one of those. It was done a little bit differently in Sparta, my friends. We now proceed over to a campfire. They're telling a story about a boy, this very scrawny boy, who was approached by a wolf, attacked by a wolf. But this young boy, he murdered that wolf. He killed that wolf. And this boy grew up to be King Leonidas, the king of the Spartans. Let's go back and see how this all started. How did they get on this journey in the first place? So we go back to Sparta, and I love this scene in the film. This is when the messenger from the Persian messenger shows up, and he shows up at Sparta, and he demands to see the king. And he basically says, he basically like soft threatens the king of King Leonidas. Basically says, like, you know, the Persian Empire, we're expanding. We got a huge army. We're looking for earth and water. And that's why I'm here. I'm here to basically make an offer to you guys. You know, you can accept us as your king. You can offer us water and part of your earth, and you know, everything's gonna be cool. But King Leonidas, he's a Spartan. He's not gonna put up with this. So he says, hey, you know, you're gonna find plenty of earth and water down there. And he's standing right next to this giant, I don't know what the purpose of this giant hole in the ground is, but it serves a purpose for visually for this comic book and for the film. And this is when, in the film anyway, when we get that the big line from Gerard Butler where he says, "This is Sparta," and he kicks the guy into pushes the guy into the hole, and that is what ends our first issue. So what do you think, just starting off with this book? One thing that struck me right away is how fast these issues go by, and that's because they're pretty short. These are actually, like, you know, including, like, I'm on page 21, or basically, no, I'm on page 19 when this ends, and so that includes, like, the cover page of the book. So I think it's only, like, an 18-page first issue, which kind of surprised me. I was like, oh, it's over already. Hasn't even been 20 pages. So I guess this is just a shorter book that probably didn't need to be five issues. Probably could have been three or four regular-sized issues.
I call Frank Miller kind of the anti-Alan Moore sometimes, because even though there's a lot of similarities between many of the works that they've done, Alan Moore, who is just a writer, his stuff is novel length. Like, the dialogue, the exposition, the mind balloons, everything. Like, his stuff is very, very arduous to get through. Whereas...
You better be in the mood for a readin' if you're going to read an Alan.
Yeah, whereas... Whereas a Frank Miller, I think, you know, being a writer and being an artist, especially since it was just him, you know, doing the scripting, the layouts, the illustrations for everything, he really taps into the fact that, you know, that this is a visual medium. Show, don't tell. That's why I always think that Alan Moore escapes a lot of people, because even though Alan Moore has written some amazing comic books, he is first a fiction writer, a novelist, and then a comic book writer. And I think he's actually said that before, and he's never wanted to adapt to it. That's why a lot of the artists that he's worked with have never worked with him on more than maybe a couple projects.
It's got to be exhausting.
Yeah.
Just reading the script has got to be like, okay, come on. Can you just tell me what to draw, man?
Yeah. With this.
Draw me a bloody swamp creature and draw me some fruit from growing out of his arms. I don't know. Just draw the damn swamp creature.
Make somebody eat part of his body. Yeah. I mean, with Miller, it's just slam, bam, thank you, ma'am, here it is. I will say that as much as I love the violence, I love the gore, I love how you don't have to guess what anything is, his illustration style is one of the things I'm going to criticize. It's not my favorite. I that's all I'm going to say. I'm not an artist, but I can definitely say that if I was ranking him and everyone else, he's not in my top 10.
Yeah, Frank Miller has a very distinct art style, and oftentimes it's hard to describe. It's not, I would not call it crisp or clean art.
The word some people use is postmodern, which is you can get the idea of what you're looking at, but it's supposed to be distorted and contorted in order to match the visual tone that the story is trying to portray.
And that is often the case. I'll say, and this is a book we're going to eventually do here. I have it on our schedule. But for example, in The Dark Knight Returns, I mean, I think his art there matches the tone and feel of that book so perfectly that while I might criticize it in any other, you know, context for that book, I think it's perfect. Frank Miller has a definitive style. He's definitely one of those artists where I can look at one page and I know it's Frank Miller. I mean, there's no mistaking his artistic style. It's very distinct, very unique.
I mean, his signature is his work. Like, there's no guessing.
So we move on to issue 2 here, and the 300 and King Leonidas, they are on the march. King Leonidas is just off on a rock staring at the big full moon and has harkens back to 2 weeks ago. So we get to see a little more of the backstory of how we got here. And even though Leonidas is the king here in Sparta is not all powerful and he's not a dictator. He has to answer to some folks called the Ephors or the Ephors. They are the priests to the old god. And he goes to them and he says, all right, fuck these Persians. These Persians are going to come with their giant army and try to take us over. But we're not having that shit. Why? Because we are fucking Spartans and we are going to kick their asses. So here's the plan. He goes over the whole plan. He's going to block the Persians up. He's going to go up the coast where the Persians are going to have to sail into. And he's going to block them with a stone wall and funnel them into what's called the Hot Gates, this very narrow cavern where they will then proceed to destroy them, basically strategically. And the priests, though, they're not feeling this plan here right now, because they're saying, look, we have this Carnea festival coming up. We got a big party going on here, Leonidas. We can't fuck this whole thing up by having a whole battle now. It's not the time. And he's like, well, if now is not the time, there's not going to be a Carnea festival next year.
Did you not get the Google Calendar invite?
It's right there. You replied yes, Leonidas. You're going to attend. It's the pancake breakfast. You're going to be attending. But yeah, they say, all right, look, Leonidas, we gotta consult the Oracle here, all right? We then kind of learn through another scene that the priests were actually paid off in gold by the Persians. So this priest class in Greece, I mean, the Persians are going all the way here. They've amassed this giant army, but they're using all the tactics. They're actually trying to buy off the priests who are, I guess, very human, even though they have all the temptations of man, even though they're supposed to be answering to the gods. So the priests, actually, we learn, are trying to take Leonidas off course of his plan to defend Sparta and defend Greece because they have been bought off by the persons themselves. And ultimately, the Oracle and the priest, they say, no, March, we're not doing this. The plan's off. You can't do this. So King Leonidas, being the leader that he is, he decides, okay, that's cool. That's fine. We're not going to, you know, I'm not going to go against your ruling here. I'm not going to go to war or anything like that. I'm just going to go for a little walk. And his wife says, oh, well, maybe you'll go for a walk. Oh, I want you to be safe, honey. Maybe you should bring your 300 closest bodyguards, closest friends with you for this walk. And so basically King Leonidas is just telling some of his close confidants, like, he's saying it without saying it, but everyone knows what he's saying. He's like, fuck these priests. Fuck the Oracle. I am motherfucking Leonidas. I killed a wolf when I was 10, and I am not letting these Persians take us over. I am going to go kick their asses. So, and his wife has only one, her only one request is to come back with his shield or to come back on it. So even his wife knows that this is quite possibly a death mission. And, but she's a Spartan too. And she is supportive of this. And she says, you know what? Go fight for Sparta, motherfucker. You're King Leonidas. Go do this thing.
As Rihanna would say, that's a boss ass bitch.
Yeah. King Leonidas, then he meets up with these folks called the Arcadians. They show up. They're like, hey, what's going on, Leonidas? You only bought like 300 people. We have a ton of people. We have like thousands of people here. And he's like, all right, so what does this guy do? He's like, oh, this guy's like a blacksmith. Okay, what about that guy? He's a farmer. He's like, hey guys, what do you guys do for a living? And they're just like, they just raise their spears and they're like, yeah, I have 300 soldiers. I have way more soldiers. You didn't bring any soldiers. You just brought a bunch of dudes. I brought soldiers. So Spartans are soldiers is what we learned from this. They are professional soldiers. It is what they do. And if you want to get some history lesson, go on Google, go on YouTube and just look up the Spartans and read about them. Because this is real shit, man. They did not fuck around. You do not want to fuck with Spartans. And that is, again, before you know it, issue 2 is even over. So the Spartans are off. They are going to march. They are marching towards the hot gates again. This is a quickie. These are all quickies.
Yeah, he's like the Andrew Jackson of Greece. Instead of being all, you know, pussyfoot and hearts and minds, he's all guts and balls like a leader should be. I'm digging this.
I don't remember. I mean, I do own these original issues back in the Connecticut vault. And I'm wondering what the issues were like. Did they pad them out with ads? I got to think because literally we're on page 34 of this trade paperback and I'm on chapter 3 now. This is 34 pages of 2 issues, including covers. So these are really, really short. And I'm just trying to remember, like I don't remember them being particularly smaller books. I have to think they just loaded these things up with ads.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you see this with Image, with IDW, mm-hmm. with Dark Horse, and with Valiant, for some Valiant titles. These companies will go ahead and fill it with house ads because they can't get enough people to actually buy a full or a quarter page ad spread. So what they do is they just fill it with stuff. I mean, I grabbed an issue of Exo Manowar recently, and it was all house ads. And it's like, you know, maybe less than a dozen pages of actual artwork and story. And the artwork that's in there is all just full page stuff. So it's not like you're really getting much out of the pages that's the one peril I will say you have with independent and more smaller publishers. You're hoping that you get a big enough artist like a Frank Miller or a Rob Liefeld or somebody like that. And they're going to go ahead and carry basically your company for the full year. So that way your smaller titles can succeed. Because at this mm-hmm. point, what Dark Horse had, they had Hellboy, which never necessarily sold that great. Kept the company afloat. Never sold amazing, though.
Yeah, critically praised, but I don't think it was a huge blockbuster at the bank.
They had the Star Wars license at this time. They had gotten the Star Wars license.
Yeah, they did a lot of licensed stuff at the time. Like I think their biggest properties, they had like Alien, Predator, and stuff like that. The Mask, that was probably one of their bigger ones too. That was really Dark Horse's wheelhouse.
Yeah, so I mean, you're hoping you can get somebody like this to really be like your flagship project of the year to carry everything else. So am I surprised? Yeah, but I mean, it's just one of these moments where it's like, yeah, if it's short, it's totally short.
Yeah. I kind of gloss over how this second issue ends. I just want to read this last panel here because they come upon, they see the Persian ships and they're thrashing about. They see like these Persians literally just like flying off the ships. Like some of the ships are just crashing into the rocks. So they're already dying. And like a lot of these Spartans, they start cheering. There's jubilation. They're thrilled. They're like, fuck yeah, these Persians are dying. We're going to kick ass. But we see the narration, I should say, of King Leonidas. And he says, only one among us keeps his Spartan reserve. serve. Only me, only the king. His thoughts are bittersweet. The fools, the dear young fools, they actually think we have a chance. So King Leonidas, he sees what's going on. He sees all these Spartans dying. I mean, Persians dying. He sees the ships crashing. But he knows there's many, many more ships. And he knows that this is nothing to celebrate. He knows that they are going to die. And he has seemingly already accepted that. Whereas it seems many of his fellow Spartans hasn't quite settled in for them.
Yeah, so history lesson, Thermopylae Pass was basically the small gap between these two large mountains that basically would allow the Persian fleet to not only go through Sparta, but then basically have a free run of Greece at the time. This is before the Battle of Marathon and everything else. So essentially what they need to do is Sparta, as this one, you know, one Greek polis, that's their city state, they're in alliance with Athens at the time. So what they need to do is they need to basically hold off the Persians from getting past them to go run through Sparta, run through Athens and all the other Greek city states. What they need to do is they just need to hold them off long enough so that way the Athenian navy, which is the strongest navy in the world at this point, can come through and take them out and basically create a giant seawall, which is going to keep the Persians away, because the Persians have larger ground forces and everything else. But as long as the Athenian navy can hold them off, they'll never be able to get through the rest of the Mediterranean Greek city states.
Right. And the Persians were hoping to just come in with their giant army, just sweep right through Greece and, just take the whole thing down, which they probably would have been able to do if not for these Spartans there holding them off, basically trapping them between the hot gates and the sea itself in time for the Athenian navy to eventually show up and encircle them and finish the job. But in order to do that, we needed these Spartans in the first place. So moving on to issue number three, we now see this really, really freakish-looking Spartan dude. He is absolutely a freak. His body is completely deformed.
It's Gary Busey.
It looks like Sloth and Gary Busey had a baby, basically. And this guy, we'll later find out his name is, I believe it's pronounced Effiates or Effiates.
I didn't even try.
I call him Effie, just to make things easier.
I dig it.
Yeah, so Effie is wandering along here. And he's just a freak. We don't really know much about him, but he's kind of following this Spartan army, and he's saying, like, we Spartans, you know, he is a Spartan, I guess, of some kind. He's wearing like a really crappy version of their outfit. We then kind of see some of the Spartan training, like these dudes are just getting walked on and stepped on. I don't know if this is training or punishment for the younger guys or what, but these soldiers are basically just these, like, the soldiers that have like the capes and the helmets are standing on top of these other like younger Spartan dudes and just basically torturing them by stomping on them. Like one,
it's
like,
good. It's good old fun. It builds character.
Some good old like fraternity college level hazing, basically just stomping on them as they're on their way to their death. We also get to see a glimpse into how Spartans are like brutally trained as soldiers from birth, as I referenced. Let's see. They also send the Persians then send along an ambassador to meet with King Leonidas. But what happens, they have killed all of the Persian scouts along the way and basically just stuck them with spears and lined up the walkway. So this ambassador has to see all these dead scouts along the way. and the end of the day, meanwhile, they're kind of going back and forth. They're seeing this Effiates, or Effie, as I call him, kind of like
the wish.com Spartan.
he's the Mega Wish Spartan, and he's just chasing the Spartan. He wants to be a Spartan. It's all he's ever wanted. It's his one wish. He couldn't meet John Cena, so he's gonna try to be a Spartan instead.
The sad thing is, we can see him, and he's nasty.
Yeah, he's really nasty. I will say, Frank Miller definitely gets across how disgusting of a individual this guy is. Basically they cut off the ambassador's arms and they send him back to send a little message. And they're like, but hey, Leonidas, we use so many of our spears. Like, are you sure we can even fight these guys with all these spears? He's like, oh, we're gonna have thousands of spears because we're gonna take all the spears from these guys that we just killed. So King Leonidas is very confident that in their fighting ability. Then Effiates shows up and he has something to say. He wants to get an audience with King Leonidas. He knows a special route, a route route in the back that the Spartans can take. But he's also, you know, he's telling the story of himself. We actually learn the backstory of Effie here. He was trained by this shepherd warrior father. So I guess he's one of these. Yeah, basically he's one of these babies like I was describing earlier that did not
get tossed off the cliff.
Well, he did actually. I don't know if he got tossed off the cliff, but he was put out to pasture, so to speak, and he was rescued by this shepherd. And I guess the shepherd that rescued him was a former warrior Spartan, but was, I guess, at the time no longer active. But he trained his son in the ways of the Spartans. He trained him to be a warrior. And Effie is telling Leonidas, like, look, I know I look like a freak here, but I trained to fight. My father's a warrior. I'm a Spartan, and I deserve to be, you know, part of your army here. And Leonidas is like, all right, well, let's take a look at you here. Can you hold your shield up? How do you hold your shield? And then he lifts his shield, and he can barely freaking hold a shield, like, at all. He's like, well, here's the thing, Effie, you fucking freak. This is paraphrased, by the way. He says, like, the thing is, us Spartans, we fight as a unit, and every single one of us protects the other one with our shields. So we hold our shield, like, up and to the left to protect the person on our left. And if you can't protect someone on the left, you can't protect your fellow soldiers, you're going to be a weak link, and the whole thing is going to fall down. So sorry, bro, but not happening. Like, you can't join. Get out of here, freak, basically.
Then you're creeping us out.
Yeah, so Effie's pissed off. Effie's not excited about this, and he runs away and jumps off a cliff. that's how upset he is about this.
Da, 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 da.
Yeah. Meanwhile, we do see a shot of the Persians, the Persian army, and then we see an awesome shot of the Spartans lined up, and just like Thanos, they say, "Come and get it, bitches! Come and get it!" So just like that, we are already through three chapters. On to chapter 4, halftime show thoughts. We've already addressed, like, some of your criticisms of the art. Obviously, these are very short issues. But what do you think of the overall feel of what Frank Miller is trying to portray here? Are you feeling the Spartans? Are you feeling the story? You know, despite the fact that it's short. It's moving along quickly.
Yeah, I think, I saw the film first before I ever read this. So, that's my base where I'm coming from. There's just it goes by really fast, and there's just some dialogue. There's just some scenes where they really kind of, you know, flesh things out a bit more. I think what I will say, though, is that when I read these issues, even when I just kind of was able to pull that part away from me that's comparing it to the film, there's a lot of suspense building up. The flashback sequences explaining what's getting here, the buildup of understanding who the Persians are, the path to get them to Thermopylae Pass. While I think the film adds in some extra fight scenes and battle and action elements, even though we haven't seen too much of that here, it gets the job done in a really good way. He understands the medium. This is why I think, personally, Frank Miller is a better comic book writer than Alan Moore, because even when Miller, and he does a majority of stuff, but even when he's worked with other artists, he's always kind of put his ego away to a certain degree in order to let the art tell the story. Because I think with Moore, just my opinion, he's afraid of being overshadowed by the artist, which is why he shoves in so much shit. So I think, you know, sometimes less is more, and comic books will always be a primarily visual medium. Let the art do it. And he does it. So even though I'm not a big fan of the illustrations and everything, I like what I'm seeing.
Yeah, I think it helps in this case here that Frank Miller is his own artist, so he gets to, you know, he gets to portray his whole vision out there. He's not competing against himself for anything, so he doesn't have to over-explain or overwrite what's going on. The whole story is his, and he is doing a lot of the storytelling visually, and I do... Well, we'll get into it more when we give our final grades. I do like the art in this. I do think it is fairly fitting to the story, but it has its issues, so I'll save that for my final grade.
I have a quick question, Mark.
Yeah.
Do you like it when writers draw their own stuff, or do you think it's better for a writer to be paired with a different artist?
I can't think of that many examples of that. So it's hard. Like, Frank Miller is my primary example. I'm trying to think of who else.
Rob Liefeld.
Rob Liefeld. Okay,
Todd McFarlane.
Okay, well, in these examples, no, I think those guys are incredible visual storytellers, not necessarily the best comic book writers. I think in both those cases, I prefer those gentlemen's art when they are being written by others. I think they both are capable of writing. I don't want to degrade them as writers, too, because I think they are pretty capable writers.
But what I will say, what I will say is I think everyone is better when you have a check and balance type of deal. Because I think what you're doing, and I've seen this with writing, you know, like when I've done my books, I hire a ton of editors. I hire a ton of line editors, copy editors, structure editors, because what I think is great might be shit. And I need people to be able to catch those blind spots and not just think of what the best thing that Remso wants to get out there, but what is best for the reader and the consumer and for the average person that's going to pick this up who does not think exactly like me. So I think while all of them are capable of doing it and they have done it to success, you know, for all of those people I listed, my favorite stuff that's been produced by them have been produced when they work with another writer or another artist.
I think Liefeld in particular is pretty good at writing books that he writes to his art. So he's able to write a story that is able to turn into an awesome visual story based on the visuals he wants to give you, but I wouldn't necessarily call him a great writer. Like, I would never want to see Rob Liefeld writing a book for somebody else. You know? Yeah. But I'll pick up a fun Rob Liefeld book.
Yeah, I mean, he even admits it. I mean, he will go ahead and basically say what you said. I mean, he leans into the medium, which is why you can have a subpar story, but people will still love it because the art carries it.
I would say, yeah. I would put McFarlane in a similar category there. I would rather see his art with someone else writing it. But Frank Miller is very unique in this case. I think he's one of the few that, I don't know, it just, even when I don't love his art, it often just feels right. It feels Frank Miller, but that can also be a flaw because you can't really be your own editor. And I'm sure in this case, I know Dark Horse has someone called an editor that works for their company at this time. I doubt you're really editing Frank Miller when you're Dark Horse Comics at this point. You know, you're just saying, Frank, please, we're glad to have you. We want your name on top of this thing. Have a blast. You want to do it in a 17-page issue? That's fine. Whatever you got to do.
I think for Frank Miller, he had actually optioned the screenplay for this years ago, but he didn't like anybody who wanted to take it on. He actually chose Zack Snyder. Huh. Like, he actually was like, I want Zack Snyder doing this. It was not just a pure studio thing. Frank Miller really wanted to be part of it. So, I mean, these are some of those people. It's like, you know, Freddy Krueger, Frank Miller, Jason, Alan Moore. It's like, if they don't like you, they're going to make it quite apparent.
Right. They will murder you at summer camp or in your dreams, one or the other.
Or write feisty, angry worded letters to the editor.
Moving on to issue 4, this issue is Combat. I should have stated this earlier. Each issue has like a title. Like, I think the earlier ones were like Honor, Duty, but now we're in Combat. So now it's getting real, and the Spartans are on the march. We start with I really do like this spread of this showing how the army is laid out as Leonidas described to our boy Effie, how they each have the shield on the left and the spirit on the right, and each one of them is protecting the man to their left. So these guys are a unit, and they are basically, they're 300, but they're also one. They're just one mass of death soldier heading forward here to face this Persian army. I'm going to read a little bit of this. I actually like this kind of push forward the narration here. Yeah. Hearts joined in silent song, we charge. Shoulder to shoulder, shield against shield, eyes locked on those of our hated enemies, relishing their mounting terror, we strike. Joined, fused, a single creature, indivisible, impenetrable, unstoppable, we push. Persians gasp and groan and gurgle and scream and stumble and tumble and fall, brains splattering across, and then you see a bunch of Persians just falling off the cliffs, just dying in mass. I mean, the Spartans are kicking ass here. Briny stone lungs sucking deep off the deadly, salty sea. We Spartans laugh like fools and keep pushing. No prisoners, no mercy. We're off to one hell of a good start. This is the first day.
This is basically like if Tom Brady was leading the Tampa Bay Buccaneers.
Yep. Down by 45, but they have no concerns that they're not going to come back. So they are facing like a bombardment of arrows, just insane. But they're kicking ass. They are destroying up Persians everywhere they go. Stelios comes up and says, like, hey, they got this other large contingent of Persians coming that way, guys. And then Leonidas comes down, and because like now we actually see Xerxes himself, the king of Persia himself, is on the way, and he is being carried on this gigantic freaking throne. And this is one scene in the movie. While it is absurd, and of course this part is in no way historically accurate, it is awesome in the movie. The portrayal of Xerxes. I mean, he just is portrayed as an absolute and mythically, or perhaps not historically, but supposedly he was giant. That's actually what they say. I don't know if there's historical evidence backing that up, but he's claimed to have been a giant, and they do portray him as such here, and even more so visually in the movie. What do you think just the portrayal of Xerxes, especially when you see him standing next to Leonidas? He's like twice the size of Leonidas. It's absurd.
I always thought he looked like an overgrown, muscular baby. Like, there's just something that's just unnatural
about his the movie, but yeah.
I mean, it just feels wrong. You just look at it. And I feel like, you know, I almost get two different feelings when I see him in the film, when I see him in print. Like, it feels really odd when you watch it in the movie, but even in the comic, it's like you're looking at this and it's like, who the fuck told him that having all those freaking piercings was a good idea? That doesn't look like a god. He looks like a Persian Uber driver in DC who loves fake Gucci.
He's got a 5-star rating, though. I'll tell you that, because he's got a sweet ride. Yeah. Hop in that Uber, you're getting carried by 100 slaves, and you got some tigers on you and some unicorn type
creatures
here.
Lots of faux leather.
Yeah, it's a badass throne, though. I'm not gonna lie. I wouldn't.
He looks like Axe body spray.
He he looks like Zeus. Zeus meets Axe body spray. You know Zeus from the movie No Holds Barred? He's a tiny Lister. Is his name.
Oh,
I
remember.
Yeah. Yeah, that's who I think should have played Xerxes. If only we could recast. But we'll see. But yeah, Leonidas and Xerxes, they're having a chat. They're having a good old chat. At one point, Xerxes walks behind Leonidas, and Xerxes has these crazy nails. He just puts his hands on Leonidas' shoulders. I mean, he is hovering over Leonidas like he is just his, like Leonidas is just a little child, a small child. But Leonidas is in no way intimidated. And Xerxes makes an offer to Leonidas. He basically says, look, man, you have no chance here. Like, we have like the biggest army the world has ever amassed. We have soldiers from all over Asia here. Like, you have no chance against us. Here's the deal. Look, we're going to take over Greece. This is a done deal. Nothing's going to change that. I will make you the warlord of Greece if you guys just lay down now. You can stop the suffering, stop all your men from dying, and I'll make you the warlord of Greece. Everything's going to be great. Leonidas, I mean, come on. You know what Leonidas is going to say. No, fuck off, Xerxes. That is not my deal. We are fucking Sparta. See you later. You're going to die. Adios. So Leonidas takes off, and now Xerxes, he is sending his personal elite guard, the immortals, I think he calls them, these creepy looking dudes with creepy masks, and he is sending them off to kill the Spartans. So we got a few more pages of battles. Basically, they're heading into they're heading along the coast here, and the Spartans are just bombarding them with, you know, their spears, their arrows. And then at one point they call in the Arcadians. So the Arcadians had joined them in this, and now we're just seeing a huge battle here. We're seeing a lot of splash pages, a lot of blood. Frank Miller likes to show us just blood splattering everywhere to get this across.
I will say he draws some of the best landscape battle scenes. There are a few other people, like there was a Hercules series that came out from Dark Horse that was not with Frank Miller, but they take a lot of inspiration from 300. So as much as I've been criticizing the way he illustrates things, he's also just, I mean, you can't help but just stare at it and just be in awe because he pulls it off.
And sometimes I feel like this is two different artists, because I feel like the splash page, a lot of the splash pages, I think are awesome. Like, I think they really convey the violence, just the chaos of the battle. But then it's more like the scenes where there's kind of more individualized action and you see more individual people, that it often feels like, you know,
he rushed it.
yeah, I don't want to say sloppy. That's not quite the word, but just lack of detail in a lot of it. But that's not, it's not consistent throughout. I mean, a lot of the big panels showing the big battle scenes, there's like tremendous detail. So, you know, Frank Miller, again, this is probably just, again, a product of being your own editor, basically, and having full control. Like you said, you hire a bunch of people to edit you because you, it's hard to be your own critic. And I think this is a case where Frank Miller probably could have used more of an editor to help him flesh this out a little bit, or another artist to be working with the layouts, or something like this to better put the story together.
Well, I mean, really think about it. Whoever did the coloring and the inking for this, they didn't really have much to do.
No, not too much. Not too much. I mean, yeah, it's one of my favorite parts of this art is the coloring. I think the coloring is actually, it's simple, but it's actually very well done and really fits the art. Yeah.
I like palette consistency.
Okay.
As I learned in my Arts 101 class in college.
I know so little about art that I don't really know what that means. You mean like kind of the same like color schemes throughout?
Yes.
Yeah, I think we get that here.
Yeah.
Just like that, before we know it, we are moving on to chapter 5 called Victory. And again, we see more battles. We see Persians now. This is one thing Leonidas touched on in his conversation with Xerxes. He's like, you know,
fuck off, Jeff Bezos.
you got all these guys here, but I have soldiers. Like, my soldiers are not afraid of you. Like, your guys are more afraid of you're whipping these guys. You know, you're whipping slaves. Like, slaves are not going to be able to battle my soldiers. And I think you see that throughout. You see the Persians are always whipping their guys to get them to go fight. But at the end of the day, you can only motivate a slave to fight hard enough to not be whipped more. But a Spartan's a professional soldier. A Spartan is fighting for Sparta. You just have no chance. So Leonidas has full confidence here, which is why he refuses to make the deal with Xerxes. So we see more of this battle, and man, this is crazy. I don't know what the Persians were thinking. I don't know if this is historically accurate at all. I'm guessing this part is not, but they brought elephants, Remzo. They brought elephants. They brought a bunch of elephants on these boats. That seems risky to me to have elephants on giant ships, but apparently they brought elephants, and some of these elephants, they're falling off the side of the cliff here. Like, people are, you know, there's all these people on top of the elephants falling off. It's just a disaster. So bringing the elephants seems like a bad idea. This actually kind of reminds me of last or two issues ago when we talked about, we looked at the Avengers run from George Perez and Kurt Busiek, and at one point they had 39 Avengers, and they go to the scene of a crime just to start a bank robbery. And it's a disaster because there's just too many of them. So they have to whittle the team down. That seems kind of like similar to what's going on here with the Persian army. I think they brought too much to the party. They brought too much shit. They brought too many soldiers, too many giant thrones, too many elephants. Like, they have, it's just way too much chaos. So how are you gonna focus this army? They went with just pure brute mass and brute force, but very little strategy, it seems. I don't see the strategy behind these elephants other than just to look cool.
They say it in the film. It's a dialogue between Leonidas and his second in command in the film that I think would have made more sense in the comic, but they actually bring that up. It's a conversation where they're talking about, you know, like, how do we defeat them? Look at them. There are swarms, they're legions. And Leonidas basically says something like, yeah, and that's the reason why they've been able to just go around basically having everyone roll on their back, because they show up with this giant show of force and nobody fights them. And the people that are fighting them are nothing like us. So these are, you know, these are giant, you know, armies of people that look badass and might know a thing or two that we don't about how to fight, but like, they're not battle tested soldiers like us. So that's one of those moments where it's like, you know, that's also why, you know, in so many scenes in the film and in the comic, you'll see all these big badass Persians run away. It's because they've never dealt with anyone like Leonidas and the Spartans.
Exactly. Yeah. And this scene here, too, I'm just going to read this part here, because you see Leonidas is just going nuts here. He's in full battle mode. It says, the day wears on. We lose few, but each Spartan felled is dear friend or dearest blood. Hearing the death rattle of his own young son, the captain. Oh, this isn't Leonidas. This is that captain, actually. The captain that I think the same captain that got into the spat with Stumblios earlier. But hearing the death rattle of his own young son, the captain breaks rank. He goes wild, blood drunk. It takes three men to restrain him. The day is ours. No songs are sung. The Persian camp goes deadly quiet. So this is day two. And the Spartans are really, they're starting to demoralize the Persians because they, like I said, the Persian camp is quiet. They are like, okay, we're this is not as easy. This is not quite the cakewalk that we planned on here.
They know that they're going to eventually win, but they know a lot of them are going to die to get that victory.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, the numbers are eternally in their favor. There's really no doubt they're going to win, but they're quickly realizing, like, this is not going to be a good time. And, like, on an individual level, like, a lot of us are not going to make it out of this because these guys are serious. We then see good old Effie. He is back, and this is a really weird panel that shows him. It almost looks like he's surrounded by a couple like Persian dancer chicks or something. Anyway, he has somehow sought counsel with the Persians after being rejected by King Leonidas. He must have
hit LinkedIn fast.
Yeah, he really went on the job market very quickly for a freak soldier if you need one that knows about a path. And he basically, he knows this other route.
Great communication and writing skills.
He says, let's see, I think this is Xerxes talking to him. He says, your gods were cruel to shape you so, friend Ephialtes. Ephialtes? Ephialtes? I don't know how to say it. The Spartans, too, were cruel to reject you, but I am kind. Everything you could ever desire, every happiness you can imagine, every pleasure your fellow Greeks and your false gods have denied you, I will grant you, for I am kind. Embrace me as your king and as your god. Lead my soldiers to the hidden path that empties behind the cursed Spartans, and your joys will be endless. Name it, and it will be yours. And Effie says, yes, I want it all. Land, women. Oh, man, what woman is touching him? Women and no wealth, and one thing more. I want a uniform. He just says, done. Cruel Leonidas demanded you stand. I only require that you kneel. So Effie has betrayed the Spartans. I guess you can't really say betrayed. I mean, they are the ones that rejected him.
It's a tough job market.
It really is. Tough job market this time of the year. The Carnea Festival is coming up soon. There's a lot going on. A lot of jobs that are out there. Let's see. We move on. We also hear the story of Marathon and Xerxes' father. So the Persians have been defeated before. It's another famous battle, the Battle of Marathon, when the Greeks defeated the Persians. And that was actually Xerxes' father who was defeated at that battle. But now the Persians are being led by Effie to this hidden goat path behind them. So they are going to come and try to get, cut off the Spartans at the pass. Dilios is pulled from the battle. Leonidas says, because I think Leonidas starts to realize, like, all right, we're coming to the end here.
We're gonna die.
Dilios, you gotta get going. He's like, no, I've been training my whole life. I'm a Spartan. He's like, Dilios, shut the fuck up. This is way more important than you just being another one of us that dies. You need to go, and you need to go tell everybody about what we are doing here, about tell them of our bravery and inspire the rest of the Greeks to finish this fucking thing and let them know what's going on here. So Dilios, he's not a fan, but he goes off, and that's his job. He's gonna go be the messenger and tell the other Spartans. Meanwhile, the immortals, They're working their way back. They kill the Thespians. There's another group of Greeks that met up to try to help in this battle. They all get killed on the way up. Leonidas has just been he now has like after a couple pages of battle here, Leonidas has arrows like all over his body. Like he has just been completely full of,
it's nothing but a flesh wound.
Yeah, and he doesn't care. He's laughing his ass off, and he is screaming for Xerxes. And this point, we got Stumblios. Stelios, he jumps in, stabs. I think this is... No, I don't think it's Xerxes. Just one of the other Persian dudes that get stabbed. Xerxes just yells, slaughter them. And Leonidas is just screaming for Xerxes and says, die! And this is when you see Leonidas. He just has like... He has like 50 arrows going at him. It's crazy. I mean, he's a mess, and he gives no fucks. He is pushing forward. He's an absolute madman. And that's when he throws the one spear, and it goes like right through Xerxes' mouth, basically. Xerxes doesn't die, but Xerxes just kind of like wipes his cheek where the spear went through it. And this is when we see just a million spears and arrows go into Leonidas from every which way. And we see Leonidas' last words here. He says, my queen, my wife, my love, be strong, goodbye. And when we see a few more shots of Spartans being killed, just arrows and spears galore going through all these guys. We also see Stelios, good old Stelios,
Stumbleos, he also gets killed as well. We see his helmet fall,
tumble down. No.
Yep. I'm going to read a little more of the narration here. This is one, I'll talk about this in our final review. I actually think of Frank Miller's skills displayed here, I think his dialogue and his narration are actually really stellar and really fitting and really help move the story along. But I want to read this part here. Should any free soul come across this place in all the countless centuries yet to be, may our voices whisper to you from the ageless stones. Go tell the Spartans, passerby, that here, by Spartan laws, we lie. And then we do see Dilios is the one. He's there and doing as he was told to do, telling the tale. And he basically just tells the whole story about what they did there. He says the enemy outnumbers us a paltry 3-1. Good odds for any Greek. This day we rescue a world from the old, dark, stupid ways, and we usher in a future that is surely brighter than any we can imagine. Give thanks, men, to Leonidas and his brave 300, and ready yourselves for war. And then we see the Spartans going off to victory. To victory we charge. So while Leonidas and his 300 brave quote-unquote bodyguards, they defied the orders of the priests, of the oracle, to wage this battle. But this battle, while they lost the battle, this battle did, and historically as well as in this book, pave the way for the Greeks to fend off the Persians and ultimately win the war. And that does it. That does it for this book, 300. So that being said, let's just get right into it, Remzo. I'll let you start.
So I try and be consistent when I'm going from one comic to another, regardless of genre, series, arc, whatever. Is this good for new readers who have never picked up a comic book before? And is this good for readers who have been, you know, more aware of what's going on? This is one of those exceptions because it's a limited series. So is this good for new readers? Yeah, it's a good self-contained limited series, very to the point. Gets that in spades. Is this also good for people that are familiar with Frank Miller? This is Frank Miller at probably his most Frank Miller-esque. So I will say he gets good marks on that. It's a short story though. And there are certain parts where, you know, I think it could have been fleshed out. I don't know if that was because he just genuinely wanted to keep it as narrow and focused as he wanted to, or if he was getting any type of editorial suggestion. I don't know. But, I mean, the story is good, but that's just it. It's that good. I mean, it's just okay. I'm going to go ahead and just give it a 3. It's a evening, afternoon, Sunday read. It's a good hour long killer. That's about it. I think 3 is pretty fair. To go any less than that is to, you know, really just kind of ignore how, you know, culturally impactful it is with the movie and the spoofs and, you know, how everyone has at least seen a few scenes from this film. But to give it any more than that in terms of just the graphic novel is to be a bit too generous. I will also say that, you know, the art, you know, this is my personal bias. He's not my favorite illustrator. And, you know, as we point out throughout, there are some really good moments, but then there are some other moments where it's like, you couldn't have spent maybe like a few more minutes kind of fleshing it out. I think when a writer does that, where he tries to play artist, he overburdens himself. I think he would have been better, you know, either having somebody do some of it, maybe having the anchor more, have more responsibility over maybe changing some of the illustrations. But, you know, this is one of those things where it's like, I don't think it's always that great when a writer or an artist decides to do both parts. I'm going to give it a 3. So overall, my score for Frank Miller's 300 is a 6 out of 10.
Fair enough. I concur with a lot of your criticisms. Overall, I do think this, I think the biggest problem that it doesn't feel as epic as maybe it should. I really think it comes down to the format more than anything else.
I think, and just to add this in, I think what ruins this for me, what brings it down, is that I saw the movie first.
Yeah.
I think the movie's a better adaption, and maybe if I had never seen the movie and I read this, maybe it would have been more. So I want to state my bias. I think the movie is better, and I saw the movie before this. So I'm constantly comparing it to that. I think because of that, the graphic novel was always doomed from the start with me for a lower score.
Fair enough. Yeah. And I mean, I read this, you know, probably a decade before the movie came out. And I do remember being more blown away by it than I am now, you know, when I first read it. I remember just being in awe of it. And at the time, maybe it was a little more revolutionary. Maybe that's not the word, but I think it...
What was it? Was it though? Like 1998?
No, probably not. Yeah. But I think that I was meant to think it was as an 18-year-old.
Okay.
it felt that way because it was Frank Miller and because it was this historical event. But at least that's how it felt to me back then. Now it doesn't feel quite the same. And I think it's the way it's broken up too. Like 16, 18 page issues. Like I almost feel like this should just be a graphic novel of just a one shot. And maybe it would feel a little more, I don't know. I like one complete story. Like, I mean, I don't know. Like he could have fleshed it out more, but I don't actually know if it was necessary to flesh it out more to tell the story that he's wanting to tell. We got a little characterization. We got to know Leonidas. We got to know Stumblios. We got to know Effie. I don't know if we need to go off and learn more about 10 other characters just to feel like it's more of a story.
Well, like the wife in the film, Leonidas's wife.
Yeah. We got more from her there.
Yeah. Like that was, I felt like that actually added more suspense to the story with her trying to deal with the bought off politicians in the Spartan Senate. Mm-hmm. Like that was pretty interesting. Some of the extra dialogue between characters that's just not there. Whereas, right now in the graphic novel, it's all being told through the narration of Stylios or however the heck you pronounce his name, that guy. In the film, it's still done that way. But they can go from, it's being told through the narration to it's being told through the dialogue. I think some of the dialogue between Leonidas and the others, some of it is here, it's planted here, but Zack Snyder fleshes it out more so.
Yeah, I think that's all pretty fair. And I think visually speaking, I think the movie is decent, but I think visually is where the movie shines for me. I mean, it's just a visually stunning movie.
Oh, it's not, it was never going to get an Oscar nom, but I think it did get an Oscar nomination for effects. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I mean, the movie goes over the top again with like Xerxes and how they depict that army, but it's over the top and awesome. So that's okay with me. I mean, I think it's a fun watch. Like you can just put it on, not think too deeply about it and have a good time. So
it is one of the most spoofed and homaged films of the modern age.
Yeah. Which is saying a lot because it's only been around for 12 years or so, 13 years. I can definitely see how this would be a disappointment after seeing the movie first, because the movie definitely feels way more epic than this book does. That being said, I don't want to judge it too harshly just because it's short. Like I don't want to encourage books to be longer than they need to be. I think a story should be as long as it needs to be. I guess at the end of the day, I'm going to rate this. This is really hard for me because I love Frank Miller, and I actually think I'm going to start with the writing. I do like the writing here overall. I like the dialogue. I like a lot of the narration dialogue. I like the dialogue. Does it blow me away? Does it deserve huge accolades? No, but it's pretty good. I'm going to give the writing by Frank Miller a 3.5. And then as far as the art, again, I like Frank Miller's art, generally speaking, and I think it often...
It's an acquired taste.
It's definitely an acquired taste, and it's partly his style, but it's sometimes it's hard to believe you're looking at the same artist because sometimes you see a page that's so epic, so crisp, so clean, as we do when we see a lot of these wide shots of the Spartan army, and then there's others where you feel like he just kind of sketched this thing together because he wanted to throw this panel in of, and we see the elephants falling, and a lot of times you just see the people, they're almost like stick figures, they're like, you can tell where he doesn't care about the details and where he does.
They're like not even people.
Yeah, it's like the anti George Perez, where he's going to give you every little freaking detail you can ever even comprehend. You could spend days and days coming over every panel because there's so many details there. So the art, I will give the art a 3. I guess I'll agree with you on the art. I like it, but there's enough inconsistency that I can't really rate it much higher than that, even though I do generally like the style. I guess 300 for me gets a 6.5, a book that I expected to give a much higher score to going into this. I would still say, so let's see, it's a second print total, a 6.5. What did you have, a 6 total?
6, so it's a 12.5 out of 20.
It's relatively low, but I would still say if you haven't read it and you don't have to pay for it, which you can find this on Hoopla, and you can read it in about literally probably 20 to 30 minutes, you can bang out this whole thing. So I would say it's worth reading despite a lower than the stellar score from both of us. I'd still say it's worth checking out.
It will add flavor to your graphic novel collection.
It will. It looks really nice on your bookshelf.
Yeah.
I'll say that. It's worth checking out once, I will say, if you haven't read it, especially if you're a fan of the movie or you're just, you know, just curious about it. I definitely wouldn't call it bad. I mean, at no point was I bored at all. So, yeah, but it's a strong 6.5, but a 6.5 nonetheless. I can't go higher.
Agreed. I mean, did you ever read Ronin?
No, that's his one work that I have not gotten to.
Oh my gosh. Like, that Ronin is...
Produce it, baby. Put it on our schedule. That'll make me read it.
We will get it. We'll get to it eventually. But, like, you know, if Ronin is like a 10 on the Frank Miller scale, I will say that The Dark Knight Strikes Again is a 0 on the Frank Miller scale. 300 is a solid 5.
So where does Dark Knight Returns fall on that scale? That's my kind of...
I would say that's a 9.
Okay.
I would say that's a 9.
Fair.
Yeah, I mean, with Ronin, it's just...
Well, that's my favorite Frank Miller work by far.
Yeah, Ronin, I think, was his biggest passion project. I don't think The Dark Knight Returns was really his biggest passion project. I think Ronin was. I think he loved doing the Dark Knight Returns, but, I mean, with Ronin, like, that is... I want to see that movie. Let's put it that way. I want to
see
that
the
movie.
Last Ronin movie.
Oh, my gosh, yes. I have not grabbed my issue 2 yet.
I just read it, so I won't spoil
it. But
anything.
But like that's the thing though. Like Last Ronin is a love letter to Frank Miller, and
that
there are so many others. John Romita Jr. draws a lot mm-hmm. like Frank Miller. Like Frank Miller,
for sure.
Like he might not be everyone's cup of tea, but to say that he has not impacted the artist community within the comic book world would be a lie. I mean, his stuff. I think Romita Jr. is a better artist than Miller. I think Laird from TMNT is a better artist than Miller. I think, you know what's funny? Matt Battaglia has actually drawn a lot of Frank Miller drawings.
I can see a little Frank Miller in Battaglia's work.
Battaglia, I think, is a better artist than Frank Miller. But here's the thing, though. It's a chicken or the egg scenario. Would he be that way if he did not grow up reading and looking at the work of Frank Miller?
Well, there you go.
It's one of those things. So, I mean, you gotta... If you might not... love him, but you, my God, you have to respect him.
You must respect him. And I will say this is good. This is quality. This is not Frank Miller's best work. This is not what I would ever give someone who wanted to, you know, dive into Frank Miller. This wouldn't be the first thing I'd give him. It might be on the list.
I'm going to give them Batman, The Dark Knight Returns because it's Batman.
Yeah, for sure. That's definitely what I'm handing them immediately. Maybe Daredevil after that. And if they graduated from that, then maybe some of the weirder stuff.
Oh, the original Wolverine Limited series, but I don't know if he drew that or not. Did he draw that?
I'm not sure. I want to say he did.
I've got it on the shelf. I'm not going to walk over to it, but I think he did that. Yeah, I think he did that.
Definitely one of the most influential just comic creators overall, for sure. So Frank Miller is somebody, it's a name you're going to be hearing quite a bit, I think, on this podcast going forward. He's definitely going to be popping up now and again because he has a lot of seminal works, and I'm sure we'll be checking them all out. But this is not his best one. This is just, I mean, it's well done. It's enjoyable, but he's done much better work. And we'll get to that work in the future. This is going to be a little bit of a shorter show than you guys are used to because we read a shorter book. But if you're craving more content, if you just can't get enough of Mark and Remso talking comics, there is good news for you, my friends, because for as little as $5 a month, you can head over to the Second Print Patreon at patreon.com/secondprintpod and check out all of our bonus content. We touched on it earlier, but you know, Remso's got Remso Rants, Remso versus the MCU. I've been doing WandaVision recaps with Dan Smots. I'm about to start doing the random Marvel Comics podcast. We are just doing all sorts of bonus content for you because we truly believe in providing value for our patrons. We want this show to always be free, this main show. We don't want to make anybody feel they have to pay just to get this content, so this will always be free, but we also really want to reward those that do send us money, that do fund the show, that do make it easy for us to not stress out about having to, you know, pay for our website fees, having to pay for our podcast hosting. This is all taken care of by our patrons, and as well as ad campaigns and all the marketing we're doing to grow this show. To not have to sweat that off our own back is just huge, to be able to start, especially for a relatively new podcast like we are. So thank you so much to all our patrons. And again, we aim to provide true value. So if you're giving us $5 a month, if you're giving us $25 a month, $50, no matter what level you're at, we really, really work our asses off to make sure you're getting value for that. So check it out, patreon.com/secondprintpod. And of course, as always, 5-star ratings and great reviews. Easiest way to help us out without spending a dime.
Absolutely. Well, that's about it, folks. Secondprintcomics.com. We got regular free content there. Cosplay, fan films, comic reviews, so much more for the veteran nerd and new geek alike. Secondprintcomics.com. As always, I'm Remso W. Martinez.
And I am the marvelous Mark Claire.
Read comics. Change the world.
Change the world.
Good night, America.
Adios.